Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Scott Guerin, 27 years of combination experience, Chief of Fire and Emergency Services for Cranberry Township. Scott got into the emergency services field from his father, but it was the EMS route which led Scott to finding his passion with public safety, starting out as a junior firefighter. Scott believes in empowering individuals to be better versions of themselves. Scott also had a hand in forming the Standard Actions for Emergency Response Group within Butler County, in which five different fire departments teamed up to operate incident commands jointly when it comes to the emergency calls within the area. Scott has a vision of trying to provide the best service possible to the citizens and all who come into Butler County. With that, I present Mr. Scott Guerin.
Scott Guerin, Chief of Fire and Emergency Services for Cranberry Township. So I started in the fire service with my father, honestly. And it wasn't truly starting in the fire service. I started in EMS. I took the opportunity to go to work with my father on Take Your Kid to Work Day. And when I went there, I was 15 years old. And we had a day like you wouldn't imagine. Everything that could possibly happen happened. And made me realize, like, hey, this is kind of exciting. This is something I really want to do. We really made a difference today. And from there, it kind of lit my fire on being involved in public safety. So from that, I went and took my EMT at 16 years of age. I was probably one of the youngest people to ever get their EMT, or one of the earliest people to get their EMT. I think I just turned 16, and a month later, I was testing for the Department of Health certification. So just like most other folks that you've interviewed, the EMS pathway led to the fire pathway. Had some common people and friends between both organizations, and I joined the Zillion Opal Fire Department in 1998 as a junior firefighter. While I was there, became the junior captain, if you will, someone that was kind of leading the charge for the younger generation, and then continued to work my way through the chain at the Zillion Opal Fire Department. When I was 17 years of age, I decided that the military would be a good path for me. Also, same thing that my father had done. He joined the military also. So I left the organization for my basic training and my AIT school, and then also two overseas deployments, one in Germany and one in Iraq. Honestly, the military was one of the best things that ever happened to me. The military was something I learned a lot of really hard lessons. I learned a lot of really good things about myself. And with the things that I experienced, it turned me from a pessimist into an optimist. When I got home from Iraq, I really told myself that, you know, there's nothing that's as bad as that place, and there's probably nothing that ever will be. So just be happy, enjoy life. And it completely changed my brain and the way that I think for what I was doing. Those overseas deployments really interfered with my career aspirations and goals of doing the same thing that my father did. He worked for a life light. He was a flight nurse and was one of the OGs that was really in it whenever they were flying all over the place, seeing some very nasty things, and the programs were just starting to build. And he was very well known for how good he was at his profession, and I was kind of trying to mirror that. My overseas deployments kind of screwed all that up. Would never take back any of my experiences, but they didn't allow me to follow my pathway that I wanted to follow. So when I got home, I found the quick route was to become a paramedic. So mm-hmm. I went to school, became a paramedic, and then I started working, and I found myself at an organization called Ross Westview EMS Rescue. Spent 10 years at that organization. 7 years I was a supervisor, aka deputy chief of the organization. And that place, honestly, is one of those organizations that they truly believe and empower their people to become better than they ever could be. They build you so good that you leave. And that's an amazing culture to have. I found one of the most important mentors in my life that worked there and really taught me valuable lessons. And I got so comfortable with what I was doing through the exposure and through the culture that I said, you know, I want more. I'm hungry. I want some more. So at that point, I realized that I really couldn't go anywhere unless I had some education. At the same time, I applied for this current job that I hold now in Cranberry Township, and I got an automatic rejection letter. Never even got an interview, never even got a discussion. So for someone that's really involved in wanting to do better, that was a real serious kick down for me. I was pretty upset. I was pretty mad. I realized, you know what? If I want to do better, I need to go to school. So from my time at Ross Westview, they allowed me to attend school and training midlife, 30 some years old. Said, you know what? I need to go get my degree. So I started working towards my degree, did it all online. And in a 3-year time period, I ran all the way straight through with no breaks from no education to having my master's degree. That was having two kids, that was working full time, that was all those other things in there. I at one point found out that my GI Bill still covered 70% of my education. And I only had 3 years left to do it. So that was my second motivating factor. I had 3 years to get this done. So I ran through it as fast as I could. And at the same time, my wife did the same thing. She went to school. So we've had two kids that were 5 years of age or less, and we're both full time in college. We changed date nights for homework nights.
Hey, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah. But it worked out for both of us. The afterwards, or during the process, we had some things that happened that continued to build me as a important part of the organization. And I'll talk about those here in a little while. But I obviously wanted more in leadership. After my time at Ross Westview, Cranberry had some changes happen. And the job that I was told no to the first time, I actually have the letter that says that I was not going to continue in the process. They actually came and found me and said, "Hey, we want you to take this job." And I was like, "How cool was that?" 3 years later, after I got told no and didn't even have a consideration in it, and now they came and asked me to take the position that I've always wanted. So it was a really cool moment. The letter that I got was probably the most powerful thing that ever happened to me. So get told no one time, what do? You can either learn from it, or you can sulk and cry and make up excuses. I learned from it and moved forward. So from there, I've been at Cranberry for the last 5 years. I had the privilege of walking in the doors when COVID hit and dealt with that here at the township, across all of the township departments, and making sure that we were doing the right things at the right time.
Okay. Very interesting. Very interesting adventure to say to get to where you're at now. All right. A couple questions. So can you describe to the listeners how the township works? Are you guys career combination, strictly volunteer? That way they get a sense of the area.
Sure. So Cranberry Township, it's 33 square miles as a population of approximately, I'm pretty sure we're right around 36, 38,000 at this point. Very big commercial and residential area within the community. It is I'll call it an upper class type of community. There's a lot of money. Homes are very expensive in this area. Who I work for is Cranberry Township. Cranberry Township has an organization called the Department of Fire and Emergency Services. And myself, a training coordinator, a risk reduction coordinator, and an admin all work for the Cranberry Township Volunteer Fire Company, completing the business that needs to be done to become a forward-thinking, progressive fire company. So all those things that plague the modern fire service, especially the volunteer side, we're here to be able to supplement them, to make things better for them, to do all that hard work, to do all the reporting, to do all of the budgeting and financing and purchasing, all of that. So the fire company is funded through a fire tax, and essentially we control all of that coming in and coming out.
Okay. And with you being the fire chief for the department, one of my questions for you is, how do you combat the recruitment retention issue? That's even if you're having that problem. I'm not sure if you are or not, but a lot of, 2025 volunteers numbers are going down due to, people have to work. They can't spend the time away from work and away from home. So are you guys seeing an issue with that, or are you doing okay?
So I think the answer to that for anyone is always going to be, hey, we have an issue with that because nobody ever has enough people, right? I don't care if you're a career department or a volunteer department, you don't have enough people. At our organization since 2019, we've implemented a staffing program. So we have 24-hour around the clock staffing by the volunteers through a stipend program. So we have a stipend that's in place. You can get paid a wage, or not even a wage, a fee for being here for set blocks of hours. During the week is one rate. During the weekend is another different rate. And on holidays, it's also a different rate as well. And we do pretty good with it. When we're looking at the numbers, we're looking at the evenings, overnights, we're in the 90 some percents of compliance of coverage of at least minimum staffing being here at the firehouse. Obviously that waxes and wanes just like anything else. We have people that come, we have people that go. We have a pretty good pipeline or a good group of people that continue to come in. I would say on any given time, we have 3 to 6 people coming in the door. One of the biggest factors that we have is that we have a training facility attached to our firehouse. Our recruitment ability, one of our biggest things about recruitment is that we have all the training that you could ever need to get through your fire service career right here in our backyard at our training center, from entry level all the way up to officer certifications. We have a lot of, but we do have a lot of unique things that happen with us. As I just mentioned, we have a community that it costs a lot to live in. Well, that's not easy for someone that's just starting out in life to live here. So I lose my firefighters that don't live with mom and dad. They flat out cannot even afford an apartment around here, and they have to go elsewhere. So that's a challenge for us. That's a thing that we have to try and face and fix. We have but what we do have is a lot of mid-career professionals that comprise our organization of some really educated individuals that are very smart. They are focused on the progression and the growth of the organization. And it's a collaborative approach between the Department of Fire and Emergency Services and the Cranberry Township Volunteer Fire Company. So it works out well. But just like anyone, we have our challenges. And I'll never say that we don't need more people.
Okay. All right. And roughly, how many volunteers do you have? Roughly, doesn't
All
have to
right,
be
about
exact.
50 right now.
50.
50 brigade responders. I would say total on our roster, we have a little over 100. That's
Okay.
including all kinds of organizational support pieces. So.
Gotcha. Okay. And how many st fire stations are you operating out of?
We have two firehouses. One's our Park Fire Station, the other one's our Haynes School Road, and then we have our training facility up at Public Works that's got 100-person classroom, is a 4-story mid-rise smoke tower with bullets panels in it. We have a burn building, we have an extrication pad, and we have a gas-fed fire pad.
Okay. And roughly your call volume doesn't have to be exact.
Last year was 1,200 calls, and that's fire only.
Oh, fire only.
Yeah, it's not EMS.
Okay.
It's
Okay.
busy.
No, I mean, if you're a volunteer organization that runs over 1,000 calls a year, to me, that's pretty steady. That is very steady.
It's steady, and that's what's driven the staffing program, honestly. Our response times are fantastic. They're well within NFPA standards. When you're looking at 1200 calls a year, you got to make sure there's people here to be able to execute. So
Right.
got people coming out constantly. We do have a home response program as well, and it's a good mix. But as with anything, it could be better, but we're always working on that. That's what we're doing as the board of directors, the brigade officers, and the Department of Fire and Emergency Services is always trying to crack that nut of how we figure it out and how we make things thrive. So.
Okay. And that stipend program you were talking about, I'm assuming the your volunteers that are a part of that, when they are there, meaning they staff, they're at the firehouse in case a call comes out, right? So it's kind of like they pull shifts.
Correct. Yeah, they
Okay.
pull shifts. There's four shifts that comprise the 24-hour time period, and they're here. They're focused on tasks. They're doing truck checks. They're doing training. They're cleaning the firehouse and just enjoying each other's company. So we have people here 24 hours a day to ensure that we're getting a response within our community.
Okay. And are any of your members career firefighters elsewhere?
We have a couple, but I would say that there are members here that are also members at other organizations, other volunteer firehouses, just like anyone else. There's a lot of us share people across the board. So.
Right.
But what I really care is people are here, they put in their requirements, and they go enjoy life afterwards. It's one of the beauties of the stipend program, in my opinion. We're running 1,200 calls a year, that if I know there's people here, I don't have to worry about it from home. You know, go enjoy your life, go have fun. There's staffing here. Unless it's something major, I don't really want to see you.
Understood. No, I understand that. I understand 100%. Okay. With that being said, in your opinion, what is your definition of professionalism?
So, to me, professionalism doesn't have to be tied to a paycheck. And I see that a lot of people reference that. Professionalism really is how you carry yourself. Whether you're a volunteer or a career or a combination department, professionalism is something that can really be tied back to you and how you make yourself function and how you make your organization function. The focus on the standards, the focus on the progression, whether that's administratively or it's operationally, it truly makes a difference that you're focused on moving things forward. If you ask anyone for the last since 1998, I've never been a fan of the adage of, it's just because it's that way just because it's always been that way. And I have fought that my entire time in the fire service. I've affectionately called myself a change agent. And to me, it really cares that you're pushing things forward. Some of the best things that have ever happened in the fire service come through uncomfortable conversations. And some of those things have worked and some of them haven't, and that's okay. But to me, it's what you do when the ones that don't work, do you throw it away? Do you revise it? Do you reattack it? How do you handle it? Those are the important ones that when you're trying to get something through that needs to be through, how you compromise and how you make things work to get where you ultimately needed to be. So, but professionalism really truly is, to me, it is just moving the organization forward in any manner, and carrying yourself as such. I've always counted myself as a professional. I haven't gotten a paycheck to do this, my entire life. At one point, I was a part-time firefighter for a local city here in Butler County. And then I got this position here, but I've always counted myself as a professional, just based off of holding myself to a higher standard.
Okay, love the answer. All right. With that being said, as well, in your opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
Aggressive. I honestly think aggressive is essentially a bad term, if you will. I think that that comes with a negative aura around it. And really, I think aggressive to me should mean ambitious. Again, whether that's operationally or administratively, means that you're attacking things on all fronts. You're building people so they get better at what they do. You're building the administration of the organization so you're protected and policies are in place to ensure that things are getting done that need to be done. But to me, it's really ambitious because without ambition and without someone leading the charge, I'm a firm believer that if you want to see change, you have to do it yourself. Ambitious fits that bill, whether that's being ambitious about putting a hose line into a structure when you don't know where the fire is, or whether that's ambitious about laying in from the hydrant, whether that's ambitious about investing your money the way that we should be to ensure the growth of the organization and we have future funds. It's all part of the organization moving forward. So I just think aggressive has a very negative tone to it that I understand what it means, but if I asked someone in the community, well, what do you think about your fire department being aggressive? The answer is going to be a negative one. So.
Okay. One question I have for you. Actually, I have several questions, but one of the questions I'd like to ask you is, with you being the fire chief of your organization, what are the standards that you have set for your members? And I only ask that because sometimes, especially like if people are having a conversation, some may look at, well, they have standards, but I don't push it too hard because the members of my organization are volunteers. They're not like a career paid staff. But to me, it doesn't really matter if you're career paid or not. But with you being the fire chief, what are your standards and non-negotiables if anybody wants to come on onto your department?
Sure. We have standards across the board here. And I agree with your statement about the pushing too hard aspect of it. But these, except for the officer standards, the firefighter standards existed well before my arrival at this organization. A long time ago, they pushed the fact that all firefighters here will be firefighter one. Now I understand firefighter one is just a check in a box and it's a written test and a knowledge test. But it gives you a basis of basis or a foundation, if you will, to start your career. So for us to be an interior firefighter and have a black helmet, you have to have firefighter one to start. And then anybody that comes through the door here, they're a probationary member until they meet the competencies that is in their skill book whenever they come in. There's a probie book. That probie book is pretty elaborate. It covers everything from what's on the fire trucks to forcing a door to hitting a hydrant. And you're evaluated on all of those. Whenever you get rid of your probie shield, it's a pretty big deal. Whenever you become a senior firefighter. So those are the standards for a firefighter. We also, one of the things that the board of directors does here really well is there's a standard for participation. So you need to be here. You need to be training. You need to be present. And there's a minimum standard that's met that you have to meet quarterly to ensure that we're continuing to put a good product on the street. One of the changes that I've seen since I've been here, we did this just after COVID, is we did an officer selection process. We got rid of the voting of the officers and the leadership. And we moved it towards a review of your skills based off of a skills evaluation, based off of an interview process, based off of a written knowledge test. And our volunteer leadership, from the lieutenants to the assistant chiefs, they're all gauged against that. They sit for the panel and they're evaluated on our joint operating guidelines that we run for SAFER and make sure that they do a virtual scenario and work through all the benchmarks that are associated with SAFER. And then they also go to do a written test based off of their level that they applied for. It's and it gets worse as they get up to the chief officer, assistant chief roles. And same with the scenarios, they change based off of what position you applied for. It could go from a simple fire to a fire with multiple entrapments and people hanging out the windows. And then the interview process. There's eight canned interview questions that we can probe down into once they provide us answers. From there, the panel sits and we review their education, their background, their time here at the organization, what they've done, how they've performed, all of that. It all becomes part of that evaluation process. and we put them in as an officer position. And then every year they're evaluated based off of what they've done, and we have an interview. And if we want to keep them as officers, we'll ask them, "Do you want to stay?" And if they don't want to stay, we allow them to go, and we replace them doing the process all over again.
Okay. That's my time doing this. I've interviewed several volunteer members of different organizations, and I love hearing the fact that it's not just the standard quote unquote, if you would say, good old boy system. I remember for me growing up as a volunteer, you would hear, through talking with other members from various different departments, it was the individual that ran the most calls. The popular individual that usually would get it. But to hear departments now that are starting to do little simple, and I'm not saying it's simple, but things like a written test and then a couple problem solving things, to me, that shows right there like you are definitely trying to set the organization up better for future, pretty much for the future and for the members as well.
Yeah, I agree. So before my time here, and actually when I first came in, they did a strategic plan in 2017, I believe it was, or 2015. Yeah, something like that. 2017, I think it was. And that plan laid out about 13 different objectives that they needed to complete over the next 5 years. One of those objectives was to put in, to get rid of the voting system and to put in an evaluation process for leadership, so you can ensure that they were meeting or exceeding the standards associated with being an officer, and it was no longer the good old boys club.
Love it. I love it. What is your opinion on should there be a time frame on the fire chief's position? And not I'm not meaning yours, but there are, I'm sure still to this day, a lot of organizations where their fire chief is voted on usually by the membership. Should there be a like set number clause, or because there are some fire chiefs out there who have been chief for 5, 10, 15, 20, years consecutively. To me, that stipends the growth of the department because it's just one individual that has the ideas. Not saying he doesn't collectively obtain the information from the officers, but there's got to be some stagnant, going
So
on there when you hold that position for that long.
I will agree with you 100%. Just 20 days ago, I stepped down as the volunteer chief of the Harmony Fire District. That's just north of here in Zonyanople Borough, Harmony Borough, Jackson Township, and Lancaster. They serve four municipalities, 52 square miles. And what I had felt after 10 years was that exactly what you are saying. That you know what? On day one, I determined the fact that I needed to find my replacement. I started searching for it, had a bunch of plans that of individuals that were going to be the next person in the role, and they I can't say failed, but they changed. They had life changes, they had things that drove them elsewheres, and whenever that happened, I had to revisit that plan every couple of years. And just recently, and since then, I also told those individuals that if any one of you ever wanted to run against me, I welcome it. And if I believe in you, I will step down. I will step down and I will allow you to run with it. And I just recently had someone said that they were interested and I believed in them. And 10 years later, I stepped down as the fire chief because I felt like I was becoming stagnant. I was just repeating the same thing over and over again. I was putting in as much effort as I could, having two children, a wife, and also being the career chief at another organization. It was very busy. Harmony's running 600 calls a year. Cranberry's running 1,200 calls a year. Just at some point, something had to change for me. And but I always said I wouldn't abandon them. I would continue the role until someone was ready, someone that wanted to do it, someone that was going to continue the progress that we've all done and accomplished. And that was my time was 20 days ago. I stepped down and allowed someone else to take the reins, and I'm working with them to make sure that they don't repeat my first 5 years and their first 5 years, because there's a lot of things that can really bog you down trying to learn. So.
Okay. Another question I have for you is, when you deal with a volunteer organization, you have members come and go. Hopefully, I'm sure as fire chief, you'd like to obtain and keep as many members as you can. But when it comes to having to say, "Hey, we appreciate you, but you are no longer fitting the criteria, or you can no longer do the skill," how difficult is it to say when to say when to a recruit that's not cutting it?
Yeah, so I mean that it's never easy. As I mentioned earlier in the conversation, some of the best things that have ever happened happen through the hardest conversations. And I think that if you tell them that on their departure, you failed them, honestly. You should have had communication with this individual all along the way of saying, "Hey, you need to work on this. You need to do that. You need to focus on this, and I'm going to help you do that." And it, but if your first conversation with them is whenever they are being told that they are no longer needed at the organization, you failed them as a leader. These conversations should have happened. It should have been happening for months before you ever got to that point of remediation training, of acknowledgement, of discussions, and likely probably you telling working with them to ensure that they're meeting the standard. But the conversation at the end should never happen until those first ones have always ha came first.
100% agreement, and I wish more individuals would see that, for sure, Chief. One of the things too that when I met you last year at the 2024 Jimmy Ellis Training Days. You talked to the crowd briefly on what Butler County or what that county was able to do with volunteer departments, and I think. I'd love for you to share that because I think, 2025, we still have jurisdictions in the United States where departments will not call on each other for help. You have one department running through another department's area while that department just sits on the front apron watching them go by. And, I know you had a part in doing something with departments, getting them all involved and trying to get everybody on the same page.
Yeah. So in 2017, actually probably started in 2016, all five agencies in Southwest Butler County, Harmony Fire District, the Callery Volunteer Fire Department, Evans City Volunteer Fire Department, Adams Area Fire District, and the Cranberry Township Volunteer Fire Company sat down at the table and started talking about how can we make things better for the citizens in our area? How can we make our departments better to serve them and ensure that we are on 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon? I'm bringing everything to the table that Mrs. Smith needs to successfully make it through her incident. And one of the things that we really focused on was at the beginning was operational, or sorry, administrative things. The administrative things were we started talking about people with facial hair. We started talking about people with traffic vests, and we started talking about seatbelt policies. And at one point, we were like, "Oh, we're gonna do this." And then we realized, or I actually realized the fact that, like, hey, this is doing nothing for us operationally. It's a complete failure. What I realized was it wasn't an absolute failure because it got us sitting at the same table and talking, but that what we were doing really wasn't valuable to Mrs. Smith. There was no reason for her to care if I had facial hair, to care if I had a traffic vest on the interstate, or that I was wearing my seatbelt on my way to her incident. So we kind of walked away at that point, and then I had an individual, you just mentioned his name, by the name of Jim Ellis, that was very well known in the area, that approached me, and we started talking about how we could develop this system of mutual aid support that would be something that we're going to really do well with. And Jimmy said, "Hey, let's have a conversation. Let's bring all the chiefs back together." We went up, we sat down, we started talking. Jimmy set up a scenario for us that he said he broke us up into three groups. One group was going to write it off of our common operational picture that we had today. The other one was going to use NFPA 1710. The other one was going to use NFPA 1720, and we were going to design our operational plan after that. He said, "All right, let's just for example, you're in Miami-Dade, Florida, and there is a fire at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. How are you going to handle it? What's your ideal complement using these three standards?" So we broke up, although we were all intermixed with the other fire chiefs from each group, the assistant chiefs and the chiefs of the organization. We all started like secretly working on a plan of like, "Hey, I'm going to get this answer. I'm going to get this answer." So we probably took half hour going through all of it. We presented it to the group, and lo and behold, whether we were using what stand, regardless of what standard we were using, we all came up with the same number of people it took and operations and apparatus. And like at that point, it all of a sudden it was a click in everybody's head. We're like, "Holy cow, we're all the same. We're all the same people. We all require the same thing. Fires don't care whether you're a career or volunteer. They just need someone to intervene with it quickly and bring the right resources to the table." And from there, we all broke up. We're like it. That was our aha moment. And then we all broke up and started working on individual joint operating guidelines that all five fire departments would run from. We would make a common operational picture. We would make a standard that people would have to meet for residential, for multifamily, for big box, and for commercial. And whenever we would come back together, we would adopt these, we would take them, we would train on them, and we would ensure that our firefighters were up to snuff. And it was a game changer for us. It took it from Lieutenant X and Captain X running two different operational pictures, running the exact same thing. If you can read, you can run an incident just as well as I can as the fire chief. And that was probably the one of the most important things that we did was that it created that common joint operating guideline. And if you read NIOSH reports, a lot of them come back with a recommendation of a lack of multi-jurisdictional guidelines being a contributing factor to firefighter deaths. And that was really what our focus was that no matter who was there, we were doing the same thing. And as a fire chief, it also made it awesome about the fact that I now went from having myself as the fire chief and running it as I expect it to now having 20 line officers that will run a fire exactly how I expect it. And that was probably the most comforting factor associated with the entire development for me as a fire chief was it was going to be run as I expected it, whether I was there or not. And so us as an organization, we continue to build, we continue to change things, we continue to modernize the joint operating guideline. It's gone through several revisions. If you go to www.safergroup.org, you can actually find the current operational guideline right on the page. And then we also took that and we started building off of it, like doing joint recruitment for each other. Because in my personal opinion, if I get someone for the Adams Area Fire District or the Evans City Volunteer Fire Company, guess what I just did? I got an asset in my corner when I need it. I don't care who it is or where they go. Just go join someone and be a contributing member that when I have this incident that everybody's coming to the table, you now showed up to help me. And that's a win. That's absolute win in my book. But like anything, we have some struggles. We have some heartaches. Like nothing's ever perfect, right? The chiefs sit down just about quarterly or sometimes when it's not needed biannually. And we talk about things. If we did right, if we did wrong, each incident is picked apart and reviewed. I listen to the audio of every incident that happens. And being very objective, I hold our standard communications form in my hand and check the boxes. Did you do this? Did you do that? And if you didn't do it, it's okay. But I just want to point it out you didn't do it and let's learn from it. So it's always an improvement process, just like anything else. Just as we're all volunteer fire departments. So Who knows who's going to be there on what day and what their capabilities are. But as I mentioned, if they can read, they can run an incident.
Right. And what I find the whole process to be awesome, because that's what it takes. It takes, because to this day you still have organizations and chiefs that it's like, you're in my sandbox, you're going to play by my rules, things like that, where all when you have that mindset, when you have departments and chiefs that operate like that, the result is the end user, the community, suffers from that.
Yep,
Because
absolutely.
instead of getting help from the closest agency, you're skipping a station to get the next station. And it's like nobody's benefit for that. Response times increase, fires grow faster, properties are destroyed. Hopefully, lives aren't lost. But the fact that you all came to the table and just agreed, hey, we need to fix some things, let's sit down, let's discuss and do it. Like you said earlier, that's a win. That's a huge win.
Yeah, and you know what? It's even a win that's gone beyond these five organizations. I'm proud to say that I've sat down with at least four other groups of individuals similar to us, and they've implemented joint operating guidelines in their communities and surrounding areas after we started it. Some of them even pay respect to the Safer Group as being like the founding fathers in the area of their development, and then also. At one point, our standard method of communication of reporting and how we are structured was seen as these guys just talk too much on the radio. They don't do this, they don't do that, and this is ridiculous. I don't want to listen to them. It's become the norm. Even people that aren't part of the Safer Group in our county are utilizing our method of operations in their organization without them ever adopting it. So to me, we made everybody better without forcing them to do it because it's become the norm. And to me, that's just awesome. I love that has happened and that everybody's improved based off of our heartache and progression.
Definitely. 100%. Okay. Which characteristic holds more weight in your opinion? Years of service, education, work ethic, or on-the-job experience?
So truly, to me, it is a work ethic. To me, you can't teach someone work ethic. It's something that's bred into them, and it's something that they have to learn through actually doing it. I can teach anyone a class. I can teach anyone to pass a test. I can teach anyone to do a simple task, but I want it so you want to do that task, that you do it before I even think about it. So to me, work ethic is where it's at completely. The fact that someone could be at a fire ground, their work ethic dictates how hard they're going to push themselves, how far they're going to go, how deep into the incident they're going to get. But work ethic is truly where it's at. It defines you as an individual and a human being. So.
That's 100%. I mean, yes. And the biggest thing is you can't teach that. That's something that has to be instilled within that individual. And unfortunately, we need more individuals that have work ethic over everything else. Because, like you said earlier, you can teach everything else, but you gotta have that heart in you to,
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. And it's something that could be developed over time. I truly believe in the fact that if you're at the firehouse and there's a negative atmosphere, there's a negative, everybody's going to be negative. But if you're at a firehouse and everybody's positive, everybody's optimistic, and everybody's doing good things, guess what you're going to do? Good things, because it's part of the environment. It's how you, I noticed at one point when I was at Ross Westview, I was working 2 24s a week, and I was coming in and I felt like I was being negative sometimes. And so one of my good friends actually pointed it out to me. Hey, you're really not yourself lately. What's going on? And I took that to heart. And I was like, you know what? All these people are taking their direction from me, and I'm driving them down the wrong road to being negative. So immediately, with my attitude changed to being very positive and making sure that I was ready for the day, because they all took their cues from me. They took their tone from me. And I immediately got a lot of successes in the fact of like, people want to be here. People want to be around me. They didn't want to be around me before, and it's huge. That makes your day with your fire family or your EMS family completely different. And then I also didn't allow people to change it. Like, hey, I smile a lot just because I'm a happy dude. Like,
Right. Love it. Okay. One of my questions I kind of forgot to ask you, and I always like to ask the guest, was Fire Chief ever the plan for you? Did you ever see yourself wanting to hold a hold that position, or was it something that came through your education and through pretty much your adventure of what we call life?
I will tell you that I truly believe at a very young age in the fire service that I always wanted to be the chief. And it wasn't just based off of like I was power hungry, because I'm not a power hungry individual. It was about the fact that I could do some awesome things. Like I understand leadership, I understand how to treat people, I understand how to collectively get from point A to point B. And I felt that I could really make an impact. And I feel like I have, at least locally. But like to me, I understood what it was like, what you needed to do to make good things happen and make people happy, to put an organization where it needs to be or on a map. Part of the other one of the other things that I'll take to my grave with me is the fact that I very happily and proudly assisted the organization in navigating through a merger. You couldn't imagine the amount of talking and communication skills that that took between me and all the other individuals that were part of the group. It wasn't just me that did it, but like I truly believe that my communication skills are well suited for the role. You just have to know how to treat people. So yes, your answer to your question is that I always felt that I would be some type of a leader or the chief of an organization and strive to do that. That's why I focused on education and officer certifications and what have you to ensure that I was setting the right example as I was progressing through the organizations.
And with what you just said, it sparked another question for me. Is education the only answer that the individual must possess when it comes to any leadership position? Because I think me personally, I think it's a cumulative thing of having education, having a little bit of knowledge, but also remembering that just because you hold that rank doesn't put you above anyone else. You know what I mean? Like communication, relationships, remembering what it's like, empathy, all that plays a factor.
I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. And to be honest with you, that education is a small piece of it. It's building blocks. Everything you just talked about are building blocks to a successful leader. So it could go from, yes, you do need to have some sort of education. And I truly believe that you need to have some type of degree to be a chief officer. And that's only based off of the fact that you can communicate well, you can type well, you have some basis for the things that you're doing, but then also your experiences. You need to know what the people inside are experiencing. You need to know that they're going to have some troubles in life that you're going to help them with. You have to have empathy for all of them. You have to ensure that all the things that are getting done are things you know about. I'm not a fan of sitting on the sidelines and being like, hey, go do this or go do that. Some days that's how it has to go. Because of like I'm so busy doing a bunch of different tasks that are very important. But if I have time, I'm out there washing the trucks with them or without them. I'm washing the trucks. Don't the individuals that forget where they came from, sometimes I can't say that they forget, but they're so tied down with tasks that they don't have time to do it. But it's really important to make sure that you have that connection with the troops, if you will, to make sure that you're going through that same thing, because I would never ask you to do something that I wouldn't do myself. So.
Love the answer. Love the answer. All right. The topic of wellness and truly being there for one another in need. As an outsider looking in, coming into Butler County, I saw that brotherhood factor, if you will, of the different many speakers that we had that talked about Mr. Ellis that knew him. And one of them that struck me was Mr. Danny Doyle, and how he talked about how if Jimmy was there today, he would hate the fact that his name and his pictures and things like that were being plastered all over. And I get it. You know, a lot of firemen don't like that kind of praise on them, but the whole event put on showed what brotherhood is. So what does wellness and truly being there mean to you?
Yeah, so what I've noticed in my time is that being there for each other is probably one of the most important things. I've had my trials and tribulations like anyone else with PTSD and issues. Specifically, when I came back from Iraq, I was a different person. I didn't find out until like several years later, but I had the 1,000-yard stare that my parents referenced of. Because of things that I encountered over there. And I had difficulties with sleeping at night. I'm not going to get into the rest of the details, but I had some very impactful events that had happened. And it changed me forever. And I never got help for it. I didn't go and see a psychiatrist. I didn't get any assistance. I channeled it all and stuck it all inside and eventually suppressed it to the point where it doesn't bother me anymore. But what I learned in the process is the fact that I am an absolutely mentally sound individual, I believe. I love problems. I love solving them. I love being in the front of issues or issues and things that could arise. However, if it happened to me, it could happen to anyone. And I've truly believed that. And it's really made me connect with the fact of that I need to make sure that we're watching out for the folks that are with us. I learned a very hard management lesson because I learned management from the school of hard knocks of actually freaking doing it and messing up and picking up the pieces and be like, all right, don't do that
Right,
again.
right.
And I had a coworker that was on my line at Ross Westview, and he was acting differently, and he was for a couple of weeks. I didn't understand why, and I attacked him, and I said, "What is your deal? You're a star performer, and you are not the same person." And what he did, he looked at me and he said, "I haven't told anyone this, but my kid is extremely ill, and he's not doing well, and he's." He's having a really hard time to the point where he's been in the hospital every day at Children's, and I felt small. Like I felt like such a terrible manager at that point that I didn't stay connected with him to ensure that his wellness or know or understand the fact that everybody is fighting a fight at home that nobody knows about. And
Facts.
I learned that lesson at that moment was like, oh my goodness, I failed to just talk to this guy. If I would have just talked to him, I would have known instead of jumping down his throat. And to me, that was probably one of my biggest wellness lessons is the fact that you need to stay connected. You need to talk to your people. You need to communicate with them. You need to check on them when they're sick. You need to check on them when they have these important moments of their lives that happen. And you need to continue to invest in your most important people. There, you guys all have them. But like these people, you need to stay on track with them because if you lose them, you're gonna lose them. And also, you're just not watching out for the team. There's nothing more empowering and nothing more that makes you feel better that whenever someone cares enough to check on you, to just be like, hey, how you doing, buddy? Now, for me, my issues and things that I had with PTSD, really, they've crept up on incidents. I had an incident where I absolutely broke down in private, away from everyone, based off of an incident that I experienced, and I framed it back onto my time in Iraq and some things that had happened. The point is that I learned from those incidents and now make sure that all the folks here at the organization are taken care of, that they have someone they can talk to. Just recently, Butler County, if you didn't know this, Butler County had the Trump shooting happened here this summer. And from there, I had a lot of friends that were involved in that incident that have never experienced anything like that in their entire lives. They were on different teams and support aspects for the organization, and they were involved in this up to their elbows. And I took the time to talk to them about my experiences post the incident from Iraq to help them get through their situation, because it was most likely the highest paced, fastest evolving thing that they will ever do in their entire career in public safety. I had the opportunity and privilege to work with them and make sure that they were okay. And to me, that just what that felt like, I felt amazing afterwards, because from my unfortunate experience, I could help someone through their unfortunate experience. And
Okay.
sorry if that
Well,
was a long-winded answer.
no need to. I mean, it's something that needs to be said and heard, especially the notion of you never know what people are going through. You know what I mean? Like, take the time to just make sure someone's okay. Have that empathy of, hey, checking, you know what I mean? Because especially because, you know, we're so quick to call each other, hey, my friends, my buddies, my brothers, my sisters,
Sure.
and without you knowing and jumping to conclusions, without like truly seeing what's going on, because most of the time, I think it's my belief that most of the time the signs present itself, but it's up to the friend to realize, did I catch that sign? You know what I
Sure.
mean? Like, afterwards, what if something bad does happen, then the person always goes back, well, there was that time there. I remember they were acting a little different, and I should have, could have, would have. But just being there is pretty much what you, that's the basis for friendship. Make sure that you're present, you're there.
Absolutely. And I truly believe that almost 90% of the people that you ever work with are your friends. Some of them aren't,
Right, right.
but like 90% of them, they're your friends. They will be there on your best day and they'll be there on your worst day. And you're going to share some of the most insane moments that any individual could ever experience. And you need to be there for each other. You need to ask them. But then also as the person too, and someone that's experienced this, you need to say I'm not okay. It's okay to say you're not okay. And I'm happy that that stigma has shifted in public safety. What you probably don't know about me is I've talked about myself for here for a while now and some of the things I believe in. I am an absolutely emotional person like you wouldn't believe. And I can cry with the best of them. And if I know that if I'm hurting, you're gonna know it because I'm not gonna be able to hold it back. And that's my sign. That's my cue that, hey, this guy ain't doing well. And so you got to learn the cues of the individuals you're around. You know their mannerisms. You know how they talk. You know how they walk. Well, pay attention to them.
Absolutely, absolutely. With that being said, before you decide to hang it up, where would you like to see yourself? I mean, is your end goal to do what you can for Cranberry now and then try to move on to something bigger, better? What are your goals? What would you like to accomplish before you decide to just hang it up altogether?
So honestly, I think with the track and the progression of everything across Butler County here in the area, the volunteer fire service, what have you, I feel that there is incredible opportunity that we're on the cusp of here for growth and development of organizations across our entire area. We all know what the national trends are and everything, but I think with how the growth and everything that's happening around here, there are some exciting things that are on the forefront that I can't wait to see play out. So to say where I want to go, I honestly can't answer that. I can tell you one thing, I'm not moving. So most places require a residency requirement, but I think there is a lot of exciting things that are going to happen in the next 10 years around here, and I'm excited to be a part of that. And if something else comes up that I can make an impact on, that's really what I care about, is making an impact. Who knows? I might jump on it, but I'm a like I said, I'm a change agent, and I've been a part of successfully rebuilding multiple different organizations and components. And if I have the opportunity to make a splash, I'm probably going to take the opportunity to make a splash. So.
Okay, well said. Love it. Love it. Chief, I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this. It really means a lot. Although I don't live in Butler County, but the fact that, like I said, the part that you had a major hand in forming the relationships with those different fire organizations and seeing how it kind of has trickled over to certain other areas means a lot for the volunteer fire service, because you and I know that, the volunteers are the numbers are dwindling, but the emergencies are still rising in call volume. So I just appreciate the fact that you have a hand in that you were able to spread that message to me when I was there at Jimmy Ellis training. The fact that Butler County puts on a fantastic program to share that brotherhood, that camaraderie, get their members out there to train. And so I just want to say th thanks a lot. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, and likewise, same for you. To be able to tell stories of lessons learned and to listen to the things that you're posting are just amazing. There's information out there that help you get better. You just gotta tap into it. I would like to welcome you back to the Jimmy Ellis weekend this year, and I'd also like to encourage you to come to what we have at Cranberry called the 24-hour ERS.
Yes, that's right.
Essentially,
Yep.
it's a 24-hour emergency response simulations of every call you could ever imagine. Ungodly amounts of fires, ungodly amounts of incidents that are just thought up and manifested in a friend of mine's head called, his name is Sean Sokolowski. You just did a interview with him, but he's a twisted individual with some of the things that he comes up with. And you would absolutely love your time spent up here with us. And if anybody's listening, looking for details on that event, if you go onto social media and you go type in the 24-hour ERS or emergency response simulations, it'll come up with a group you can join. You can see all the things that we've done. It's pretty amazing and incredible. We've absolutely built better firefighters from the event.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And another individual that you mentioned that doesn't want credit,
Yes.
a man of a man of very short words. He's to the point, and he's not going to go any more than that. But
Yeah.
no, I appreciate it, Chief. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.